Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. At AJR, we are committed to offering a comprehensive range of exceptional services, including applied sports science analytics, healthcare and sports medicine consulting, and leadership and coaching development. To learn more about AJR, visit their website at ajrsportsscience.com. I'm your host, Andrew Rizza, an allied healthcare professional with over 25 years of experience. My career has primarily spanned private physical therapy and public school athletics. Driven by curiosity and a passion for the industry, I created the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast to explore the ever-evolving landscape of healthcare with a focus on sports medicine, physical therapy, athletic training, and sports science. Each week, we'll dive into the challenges healthcare professionals encounter and discuss how collaboration can enhance understanding within the industry. Our goal is to improve the experience for patients and athletes alike. Now, on to the show. On this week's Behind the Sports Medicine podcast, I'd like to welcome Dr. Jessica Aidlin, Chief of Spine Surgery Division at Newton Wellesley Hospital, as well as the Medical Director of the Newton Wellesley Spine Center and a spine consultant for Boston College Athletics. At Newton Wellesley Hospital, she has led several institutional initiatives to improve access and care for spine patients. In the area of orthopedic research, she has several peer-reviewed published journal articles in her areas of expertise, particularly related to spine surgery. She credits her success to the many strong professional mentorships that she benefited from. From over a decade, Dr. Aidlin has paid forward the knowledge and guidance she received in the beginning of her career by teaching residents and fellows with a specific focus on female leadership in a male-dominated field. She graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Biochemistry at Le Moyne College, where she also played Division II soccer. She attended medical school at the University of Buffalo, where she was very active in working with their prestigious Department of Orthopedics, doing research in sports medicine and joint arthroplasty. She completed orthopedic surgery residency at the University of Massachusetts and pursued a fellowship in adult reconstructive spine surgery at Brown University. Dr. Aidlin thinks fondly of minimally invasive spine surgery as art and science combined. She sees time and time again how choosing the right minimally invasive procedure for a patient gives amazing outcomes that boosts their quality of life immediately. Her heart is to give her patients, no matter their age, the quality of life they deserve, from the 65-year-old marathon runner to the 18-year-old landscape employee. Her holistic approach includes facets such as patient education, preventative measures via lifestyle changes, nutrition, exercise programs, psychological evaluations, and more. The team approach, in conjunction with her minimally invasive techniques, allows the patient who needs surgery to experience quicker and stronger recovery, less need for opiates, and the best solution possible. Now, on to the show. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. This week, I have Dr. Jessica Aidlin, the Chief of Spine Surgery Division of Newton Wellesley Hospital, as well as the Medical Director for Newton Wellesley Spine Center and a consultant for Boston College Athletics. Dr. Aidlin, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited for our conversation today.
Can you tell the listeners a little bit about you, just a brief summary of how you got into medicine and what drove you, to become or focus on spine as an orthopedic surgeon?
Sure, yeah. So I'm an orthopedic spine surgeon. I'm board certified and been in practice now for about 15 years. Originally from upstate New York, I grew up, you know, playing sports and being pretty active. Was really involved in, or interested in science and kind of the human body, even at a young age. My parents, no one in my family was physicians, so I didn't have a lot of exposure as a kid, but I knew it was something that I was interested in. In high school, I was actually exposed to orthopedic surgery when my soccer coach's husband let me come into the OR and watch some ACL reconstructions, which was pretty fun. So I kind of got sold at that point that that's what I wanted to do. And then, you know, going on to college and med school, really kind of stuck with that path of wanting to do surgery and the idea of restoring function for patients and doing procedures. And a lot of the innovation that was going on was super cool. There were definitely some roadblocks as a female getting told like, oh, you can't do orthopedics. It's, you know, it's an old boys club. You're not strong enough. So a lot of challenges along the way there, but I really, kind of stuck with it. And I'm super passionate about it and love what I do.
Yeah. It's interesting you say that because you think of orthopedic surgeons. And again, it's like looking back to the, I guess, the good old days, they would say, is like a good old boys club. But I feel like some of the best surgeons that we deal with day in, day out, especially in the Boston area, are female surgeons. And I have to say, it was a great opportunity to meet you. You came into our clinic and talked to our staff, and they were excited to know that you're in the area to be able to have someone else to relate to. And I think it's great, you know, the roadblocks that you face kind of getting into medicine in general, and how do you choose? I know I talk to surgeons all the time about how do they get into their practice and what do they do, and what kind of drove them to the surgical piece versus general medicine or to cardiac care or respiratory care? Like, what was it that fueled them? And I think you said it best, is you mentioned that you want to restore function, and that's what we do. We want to make people better, and that's what we get in it for. So I'm excited that you're right down the street from us and we can always refer and collaborate with patients. It's great.
Yeah, no, I love our partnership. And, you know, likewise, I think you guys take great care of my patients, and I definitely appreciate that. And, you know, that is really the testament to the team-based approach that it takes to restore function and, you know, to help patients get better and get their quality of life back after, you know, after any injury. And, you know, spine is really, I thought I was going to do sports medicine initially. And I've just been able to sort of kind of bring everything together in my spine practice. I find spine super interesting. As far as like, there's no two cases that are the same. I have a pretty broad patient population and things like that. So it's extremely rewarding.
Which is good. Can you describe a little bit about your current practice, and then how do you manage really your patient population? I think we've had some good conversations around it, and like the holistic approach. Can you describe a little bit about how you guys operate with the staff you have now?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, again, I think the great thing about spine is that I can take care of just a huge range of patients and different pathologies. You know, I take care of teenage athletes all the way up to patients in their 90s who just, you know, want to be able to walk to the grocery store, you know, through the grocery store. So it's really rewarding for me to be able to connect with a lot of different types of people. You know, I do definitely have a pretty large population of very active, motivated patients, a lot of athletic folks that come in. And I think it's really, you know, I've really built this practice around educating people on, you know, what it takes to maintain their spine health and to prevent further issues down the road, regardless of what we decide to do for treatment. So, you know, it's really about not just looking at their spine, but looking at them as a whole person. Like, what does their nutrition look like? What is their sleep quality? What is their stress level? Their psychological health? All of those types of things are super important, and they really do impact patient outcomes.
And that's great, because we talk about, you know, you mentioned outcomes in that last sentence. And that's the one thing that drives us, I think, day in and day out, is what do the outcomes look like? Because if we're not getting great outcomes with patient care, then I feel like we're not doing the patient any justice. So I think that's an important piece to try to kind of continue to look forward to, is how is that improving your patients every single day? And you had just brought the whole patient in. You talked about nutrition. You talked about sleep health. You know, I always also talk about like mental health. How does that play into patients' recovery? And sleep is that one huge factor. If somebody's not getting sleep, like I, you know, talk about patients that we see with rotator cuff repairs, if they can't sleep at night, then they are miserable and they don't heal well. And the same goes for anything else orthopedically. So what is your conversation with patients when they come in? And they're coming in and it's that patient that needs to have a procedure done, say it is a, you know, a disectomy or a laminectomy or anything that is surgically related when it comes to them, how do you have that conversation about, you know, total health for them? Well, how does that work? Do you have people that you end up referring to help certain populations, or is that done in-house, and how do you guys address that?
Yeah, it really depends on the patient. I mean, I think the first thing is really listening to the patient. So I, you know, someone comes in and number one, I want to hear about, you know, what their goals are, and really developing that trust and rapport. So I let them know that, you know, I'm there to provide care for them, but they are also part of the team. So, you know, I really try to get a lay of the land as far as what their life looks like day to day, what it looked like before they had this problem and what they want it to be, you know, kind of moving forward. So, you know, hitting on all of those pieces, we do that. And then I can get, you know, a basic landscape of what that person needs and what they are. And then we do have many resources that we can use for patients who need it. So we have, you know, nutritionists, physical therapists, obviously, which are super helpful in helping to care for patients, pain management, behavioral medicine, pain psychologists, you know, all these things and all these people are really important to that team-based multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary approach to patient care. Because I tell people, you know, I think I'm halfway decent at what I do, but I'm also not a magician, and just doing a surgery is not going to be enough to get them that good outcome most of the time. You know, we really want to look at all of the pieces of the puzzle and make sure that we're optimizing all of those things.
Yeah. And I think patients are very, I guess, skittish when it comes, they hear surgery, right? And that's the one thing that our job is, as, you know, clinicians, when we're treating them, if they're coming in first to see us for that first 6 to 8 weeks of therapy, is to discuss with them, hey, we're going to try to see if we can get your quality of life better without having to do this, but we do have an option for you, and this is how we're going to steer you if you're not getting better. But it's nice to know that there's that discussion on the total person. Or I always relate to people as athletes, but because somebody's an athlete and however they operate in their day, if they're just a stay-at-home mother, they're an athlete in the home. If they're, you know, someone that is playing pickleball, they're an athlete at whatever level they're at. But I think the important piece to this is that, you know, you're looking at the total person and you're gearing them towards a life of great outcomes, but being functional in their life and not having to sit on the couch for the rest of their life. That being said, if you have somebody that is coming in to see you that has to have a surgical procedure done, can we talk a little bit really about where surgery has come in the last maybe 5 or 10 years? And we look at kind of disectomies to what laminectomies used to be and what the current research is showing, what are the newer techniques that you're using, and how is that improving the quality of life? And really, you look at the lifespan of the patient and what they want to do. What are some of those techniques that you're using, you're finding good success with?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think I would preface this with something that you said before about patients having fear of coming in and having this conversation with me and even thinking about the possibility of surgery. So, you know, I always tell patients that knowledge is power. Like, you don't have to sign up for anything. I'm not chasing you down the hallway with a scalpel in my hand. You know, like, this is all shared decision making that we do. So, but I think when patients do understand things a little better, it helps us to make decisions on what's best for them. And, you know, the other thing about spine, it's super nuanced, right? So there are, you know, people have MRIs that we know are sort of normal age-related degenerative findings that they may have, and that may not correlate with their symptoms. So I think one of the most important things before we're even talking about surgery or what the right surgical procedure might be for them is, number one, figuring out, does their symptom correlate with the imaging? Can we, you know, kind of pinpoint the pain generator? And also, have they really tried non-surgical, you know, conservative and alternative modalities of treatment? Because I think that's really important to make sure that patients do that first. Like, we're not rushing anyone into spine surgery unless they have, you know, some progressive neurological deficit or something that that would warrant that. So that being said, you know, I think that surgery is extremely successful if you're doing the right spine surgery for the right patient for the right problem. It's really successful. So, you know, going back to listening to the patient too, it really is important to know, do they have predominant low back? So, for example, let's talk about lumbar spine pathology. Do they have low back pain? Do they have leg pain? You know, what can we fix with surgery? What can we predictably get a good outcome with? And that's a really, you know, nuanced conversation to have with people. And it's important to tease that out, I think. So, you know, lumbar discectomy and laminectomy, for example, let's start with that one. So discectomy is a highly successful operation for patients who have, you know, focal nerve compression with, you know, radicular pain in their leg from a herniated disc. If patients do exhaust all non-surgical treatments and they still have limitations in their function and their quality of life, then surgery is a very, you know, good option, and the outcomes are excellent for relieving that leg pain. You know, I think that I try to tell people that surgical outcomes versus non-surgical outcomes for discectomy at 2 years are about the same. However, you know, similar to your population, patients just don't want to wait that long for their symptoms to get better. So a lot of people do get better without surgery, but those that don't, we really want to get them better quicker, I think is really the way that I frame it for people. We do microdiscectomy surgery. I do endoscopic techniques now for discectomy, which is just a less invasive way of getting that herniated piece out and relieving that nerve compression. I use the jelly donut analogy for people for lumbar disc herniation. So we get that little piece of jelly out, and you know they're minimally restricted after surgery, and they can really get back to their lifestyle pretty quickly. So especially for specific athletes, depending on what positions they're playing and things like that, we know that the outcomes for you know the surgical outcomes are good, and the return to play rates are very high. So that's definitely one of my favorite operations to do because it's highly successful. We know patients who have severe lumbar spinal stenosis who, you know, have limited walking capacity and they become deconditioned because they can't be as mobile. We know that patients who have laminectomy do well with surgery, and they actually do better with surgery than without surgery. So that's another thing that that we do a lot of. And I really try to incorporate these less invasive techniques for people. And then, you know, I'll talk to you more about different fusion techniques, minimally invasive fusion techniques, motion preservation, things like that.
This is actually an interesting question because I have, you know, patients that come in that have, you know, have degenerative disc changes and degenerative bone changes. And they ask the question of, well, what should I do? You know, the therapy, I'm getting stronger. I feel better. I still have the leg pain. I still have some muscle weakness. And they're a candidate for a procedure. I think we've had a couple people come in from you that have had disc replacement. And when is that conversation come up with a patient, just so the listeners understand, like people say disc, well, I didn't know there could be a disc replacement. What does that mean? You know, people are like in awe that that can happen. They hear of, you know, shoulder replacements, knee replacements, hip replacements. They don't hear about disc replacement. And we've had several of cervical and lumbar spine patients that have come through, that have been patients of yours that have done phenomenal and have been a really quick turnaround with therapy, and they're back to their regular activities. And they're like, we feel amazing, like no neurological symptoms, no muscular symptoms, and back to their normal activities, whether it be industrial work or if it's recreational athletics, whatever it may be. And they do amazing. Can you speak a little bit about when that conversation comes up, like, hey, who are those people? Who's that population? And when does that conversation become a starter with those people?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, disc replacement is really motion preservation. So I think that, again, the technology and the innovation has gotten to the point where it's just gotten a lot better. And, you know, the outcomes are really excellent if you're doing the right procedure for the right patient, like I said before. So I think that, you know, that conversation comes up when, again, patients are having symptoms that are just not, you know, getting completely better with these non-surgical modalities. And I tell patients, think of pain and function separately, but also together. Because a lot of people, their pain might be getting better, but they're still not functional because they're really, you know, self-limiting all of their activities. They're like, you know, I'm not traveling the way that I wanted to, or I can't go to this work meeting because I'm just afraid that my pain's going to get worse again. So like, that's actually a really important piece to talk to people about. It's not just the pain, but how are you functioning overall? And, you know, cervical and lumbar disc replacement, we don't have to, you know, kind of wait for the fusion to happen. We don't have to restrict as much after the surgery. You know, these are outpatient procedures for the most part for cervical disc replacements, lumbar disc replacement, potentially outpatient versus one night in the hospital. So patients are restoring their mobility very quickly. They have minimal restrictions after the surgery. So we can get them back to work quicker and back to their activities quicker. And I mean, you know, I'm a very big proponent of early mobilization, early like isometric core strengthening right away and things like that. I mean, the more that they move right after surgery, that I think the faster they're going to heal and the better off they're going to be. They're going to heal stronger and better. So, and you know, the thing about motion preservation is that, so FDA approval for cervical and lumbar disc replacements is one or two levels. So if you have three levels of disc pathology that is symptomatic, then, you know, we may be getting out of the window of being a candidate for a motion preserving operation. But for those patients who are candidates for it, one of the biggest advantages of doing these motion preserving operations with these implants is to hopefully prevent adjacent segment degeneration down the road. So patients who are younger and active, who are putting a lot of stress on their backs, we want to preserve that motion and keep that more normal biomechanics to hopefully prevent them from having other disc issues in the future. Now, of course, that is not a guarantee. It's not zero, but the data is pretty good at this point that we have, you know, we can get 20 plus years out of these disc replacements without having a reoperation.
That's great. I mean, that's good to hear because there, you know, that wasn't really a conversation or a starter with a lot of patients, you know, several years ago, right? Or even a little bit longer. What's the type of material that's used for the replacement? What do you guys end up using?
Yeah, so it's essentially, it's like a titanium plates like above and below. And there's like a polyethylene plastic piece in the middle that acts like the normal disc. And so, you know, the way that we place the implants is very safe. It's minimal kind of bone resection to get the disc replacement in. Certainly takes we want to make sure that we're careful and meticulous with how we're placing the implant, so it's not off to one side. We want it well centered in the disc space to kind of recreate that biomechanics. But it's a very very fun operation, and patients do really well.
Now, how do you measure for that? Is that something that is, what's the standardization? Is it you imaging and you measure through the imaging to get the right disc like height? How does that work?
Yeah, that's a good question. So a lot of it, we do some measurements on the preoperative imaging, but a lot of it's actually intraoperative trialing. So once we get in there, we put different trials and similar to like a hip replacement, we kind of, size it correctly in the operating room. And then, you know, the rep is there to give us the appropriate sized implant that we place. And then we get x-rays in the operating room to make sure everything is sized appropriately and in the right place where we want it. So yeah.
Is there any fixation bone to bone or no? Just the replacement goes in and that's it?
So there is fixation. So, you know, depending on the implant, there's a lot of different companies out there that make these implants, but most of them have like little teeth that give you that initial fixation into the bone, and there's bony on growth. So that bone will sort of form and interdigitate into the surface of the metal on the end plate. And that's really going to be your fixation. But there is very stable initial fixation, which is why, you know, we don't really have to restrict people too much after the surgery. You know, over time, that thing will really fixate in there. But the initial fixation is good enough that we don't have to restrict people.
Okay. Switching gears a little bit and talking about injections. I know this is kind of a big conversation piece that we have with patients all the time. I always tell patients, if you have pain, the doctor offers you injection. I said, raise your hand for the injection, depending on what they want to do to help with the pain. More and more people, they shy away because they've heard nightmares of, you know, cortisone injections and what that's done over the years for people. And can we talk a little bit about when you as a surgeon would discuss cortisone injections with a patient for anti-inflammatory properties or a modality? And then when does biologics come into conversation and how does that help your patients that are kind of on the edge of, you know, I've tried the cortisone, I've tried therapy, it's not working. When does biologics really help in that conversation with the patient that's suffering from pain and debilitation?
Yeah, so I actually think injections are a great thing for most people, especially in the acute phase of, you know, having a radiculopathy, for example. So if someone has a herniated disc or an acute nerve compression or irritation that's causing radicular pain, I mean, nerve pain is really painful. And I think that the cortisone injections can be a great way to manage their pain, especially while they're doing physical therapy and trying to get back to their lifestyle, whether or not they have surgery. I think it's a great way to help manage them and decrease that inflammation. Now, obviously, we don't want to see patients who are having like multiple injections multiple times a year for years on end. I mean, at some point we have to kind of figure out what the end game is and you know what we're doing here. But I do think injections can be really helpful. The other thing about injections for me is that diagnostically they can be helpful. So you know, a lot of times we see patients with lumbar spine disease, they have hip arthritis, or you know, rotator cuff issues and cervical disc problems. So it's like, how are we figuring out what the pain generator is? So we can do you know, either cervical or shoulder injections or hip injections to help figure that out. We can do specific nerve blocks at a specific root in the spine to figure out, you know, what is there one level or one disc that we can focus on that is probably causing the pain. And again, this is a combination of what the patient's symptoms are, what their radicular pattern is like, what their exam is like, and then maybe we can kind of pinpoint from there with diagnostic injections as well. The other thing about, you know, the next step after injections is that there are other different modalities that my pain management docs will use, such as radiofrequency ablation, like different things like that to help with facet-mediated pain. We can do endoscopic medial branch transections now. Those are mostly surgeons doing those procedures, but again, very quick, minimally invasive procedures to help with facetogenic pain. So there are sort of less invasive interventions that we can try. Biologics are a tough one, I think, for spine. You know, as you know, there's a lot of good data for soft tissue injuries and tendinopathies and things like that with biologics. You know, PRP and other modalities like that in the spine have been, you know, there's pretty scant data on them now. I think a lot of people are doing some of that stuff experimentally, and it is working for some people. I would say probably more like for facet joint pain than sort of nerve compression. But I think that it's exciting because I think there's a lot of research going on, and you know, doing stem cell work and different things like that with spine that should be you know, hopefully developing some exciting treatments in the future that are, you know, that are helpful.
So we talked about injections a little bit. I'd like to just go over, if we have a patient that has exhausted physical therapy, they're on their way to a home exercise program intervention on their own, like independently, and they're still getting those symptoms that are, you know, a little bit motion restriction. They're still having some radicular symptoms and they just do not want to go the surgical route. When we talk about injections to manage symptoms, how many times a year can they get those injections? Is it once every 6 months? Is it three times a year? How do you discuss that with the patient? And is it individual by individual? And how do you guys separate those patients?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I do think the short answer is that it is individualized. So, you know, I think it's really kind of framing again, you know, what are the patient's long-term goals? What is their overall health? Like, what do they look like from a patient perspective? Do they have really poor bone health? Maybe they're not a great surgical candidate anyway. And what's their function? So I think that when we talk about injections for maintenance pain management, first of all, I just want to really make sure that the patient is actually getting some relief from the injection. So patients were like, oh, I had an injection and it lasted 2 weeks. Well, that's not really a successful injection. If they say it lasts for 4, 5, 6 months, it's like, okay, well then, you know, continue working on your strengthening and your mobility and doing all the things you need to do. If you have some recurrent symptoms, totally makes sense to try another injection because you're getting some decent traction out of that treatment. And I will tell you that for the most part, this is a very common scenario, right? Like, and I support it for patients, right? Like I tell people, you know, don't necessarily rush into surgery if you're not ready. You know, no one really needs spine surgery unless you're, you know, having a true, you know, neurological problem, or an instability issue that is creating an issue. So, you know, I think that it does make sense to have patients kind of do those things, for maintenance. And at the end of the day, these problems usually declare themselves, meaning, you know, I'll see a patient for an issue, they'll have a few injections over a couple of years, and then ultimately they'll come back and they'll say, you know what, like, you told me this was going to happen, but I'm here and the injections aren't really working anymore. And it looks like my, you know, things are getting worse. So then they start to wrap their head around more, you know, would surgery be an option for me? Can I actually, you know, move forward with that type of treatment? And, you know, I think it's great when patients, when we take time to develop a relationship. So like, I don't love seeing a patient and signing them up for surgery on the first visit. So, because it does take time for people to wrap their head around this and understand what's going on and what the treatment options are and things like that. So, so these types of other options help them, you know, kind of figure things out over time. You know, there is no specific number of injections per year that you can or can't have, but I would say it's really more dictated by, you know, what kind of relief they're getting and are they actually helpful and worth it to do.
That's great. That's a great explanation on, you know, the why and the how. Just to describe to the listeners about how injections work, it's not like you blindfold yourself and like throw a dart at the dartboard. How do you administer the injections? They know because they're freaked out, like, it's my spine. Like, what are they going to hit? How do you end up administering the injection?
Yeah, so injections are super safe. I actually, during my fellowship training at Brown, one of my mentors actually did injections. He was a spine surgeon who did his own injections. So I did that during my fellowship. And for my first 3 years in practice, I was doing my own injections. So now at the Spine Center, we have our physical medicine rehab docs and our pain management docs doing the injections. But they're extremely safe. It's basically a pretty straightforward procedure where we bring you in and we do a fluoroscopically guided injection. So we can actually see under image guidance and with contrast where exactly the injection is going. And, you know, the risks of the injection are quite low. And they put local anesthetic in there and make patients very comfortable. So a lot of times the apprehension, I tell patients, is worse than the actual procedure itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people do get a little weirded out by it. And I've told them more often than not, and the patients that we referred over to you, I've always said to them, again, like, this is going to help either one, be very diagnostic, or both diagnostic and then hopefully pain management to help you so we can get through the therapy, because the last thing they want is they're here to see us for a reason. They're in pain. They have loss of function. They're miserable and we're trying to make them better. And that's a key component. I think working as a team, like we talked about at the very beginning of this interview, like the holistic approach, like looking at the total person, working on all the things that are helping to make them better. Is going to make a happier person and a better outcome for that person. So I think it's important if we have those relationships, and you guys are doing a great job with that.
The other thing that I will touch on as far as surgical approaches, and I don't know if you were going to touch on this, but with spinal fusions, I know we talked about motion preservation and decompressions, but you know the technology with spinal fusions has come an enormously long way as well. So you know, I do robotics and navigation, which I think is extremely helpful for patients to have less invasive procedures that preserve tissue and get them mobilizing quicker. So those short term outcomes are extremely good. I would say that probably the data doesn't show that long term, like having an open spinal fusion versus a minimally invasive fusion, really makes a difference. But I think that I really do believe in that tissue preservation and that early mobilization for people. And I actually do think it can help to decrease the risks of sort of adjacent level problems if you're preserving tissue. I mean, there are so many things that factor into this, such as, you know, alignment and how many levels we're fusing and all those types of things. But, you know, the safety and the accuracy of these procedures now is extremely high. You know, we can see exactly where we're putting screws and cages into the spine in the operating room in real time as we're doing it. We're monitoring all the nerve function in the operating room as we're doing it. So, you know, very safe and effective procedures. And I think a lot of people just, they think of spinal fusion as like the old school open way where you're like in the hospital for 3 weeks and you're on bed rest. And it's just so completely different now.
Yeah. And you said robotics, and I think people might hear that and think of the Terminator, like doing the operation.
Yes.
Can you describe like how that works? I mean, I know how it works, but can you tell the listeners, like, what does that do to make their life better and their outcome better?
Yeah. So essentially, I'm not just like sitting on my living room couch, like, you know, playing a video game remotely and like having a robot put in spine hardware in the hospital. So that's not what a robot does. But what it really does is, so number one, we can actually pre-plan all of the hardware to be very specifically placed by the robotic, you know, technology. So I can do a multi-level spinal fusion and actually have it all planned out before I even walk into the operating room with, you know, adjustments and sizes of screws and cages and things like that. So that's awesome. And then the other thing is that, you know, essentially what it does is we use navigation and so I'm still putting in the drill and the screws and the cages, but the robot is actually guiding me as to like where we pre-planned all of that hardware to be placed into the spine. And so it takes into account it's really great for specifically with patients with spinal deformities and rotation and scoliosis and things like that, because it's super accurate. And so we know that the hardware is, you know, in the right place where we want it. The accuracy is definitely better. Freehanding screws can be a little iffy. There's a higher risk of sort of malpositioning the screws and cutting out of bone and things like that. So I do think the technology is great. And then the best advantage, I think, is that we can make small incisions and, you know, the robot and the navigation tells us exactly where to go. So we can make a small incision with minimal muscle disruption and soft tissue disruption, you know, and preserving all those midline structures in the spine. So it's really remarkable what we can do now.
Yeah, I mean, less trauma, faster recovery is what we want, right? And then, you know, longevity of that segment being as stable as it can be for as long as it can be. So it is, like you said, it's pretty remarkable stuff. And I can see that, you know, it's definitely just going to keep evolving and more innovation on, you know, you as a surgeon and your colleagues and trying to get better product out there for the patient to make their life better, which is amazing. How does PT fit into your practice? I know everybody talks about PT. Like, how does that work? What are you looking for in a group, or how do you navigate your patients to understand what the importance of PT is to them? What does that discussion look like for you guys, and how have you used that in the past?
So that's a really good question, and I think that I really wholeheartedly believe in the importance of physical therapy for a few reasons. So number one, I really like it actually for prehab for patients, because I think if they can get some, you know, functional mobility and things like that before they have surgery and kind of learn some of the techniques that they need to do, you know, after surgery, I think is very important to make sure that they have the best optimization of their strength and their function before they even walk into the hospital for their surgery. And then, you know, postoperatively, I really, you know, again, getting patients to engage the right muscles and do their muscle balancing and understanding that it's not really just their back muscles, but it's their upper body strength, their postural strength, their leg strength, you know, all those things are so important in their recovery and their rehab. And, you know, as you know, if patients are more frail, it can take a lot more work with PT versus somebody who's, you know, a professional athlete who just has a discectomy, who's probably going to bounce back quicker. So it's a different rehab program for those patients. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, with every single patient, it's very important. And, you know, I would definitely not underestimate the benefit of just having some structure and accountability and reliability for patients when they're kind of forming those habits after surgery. So I tell people that they're like, oh, I can do it on my own. I'm like, you know, it's better to go in and do structured PT for strengthening and manual modalities and things like that, because it is going to keep you accountable. And the goal is to maintain that over time. Because like you said before, it's not like you're going to see the patient forever. You're going to discharge them and they're going to be responsible for their own, you know, programs and things like that. And we want people to develop those habits, because part of my conversation with patients is that this is like a lifestyle changing thing when you have a back injury or a surgery or something like that. Like, we want you to be able to prevent this from happening again in the future. And how do we do that? It's not like you have surgery and you're like, okay, I'm done. Like, right. I can just move on with my life. Like, you really got to have some different perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%.
So I think PT helps to do that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think once they understand that it is, and the tough part with patients is they want like to flip the switch, like a light switch, and everything feels better. And that isn't the case, especially where we find that, you know, acutely with cervical and lumbar spine pain, acutely we can get them to feel better hopefully in the first 3 or 4 visits. And then after that, it's really working on a lot of their postural changes that have probably been going on for 10, 15, 20 years. And that doesn't happen overnight. So for them to understand like the background of what we're trying to do for them and how we're going to change that, a lot of that bounces back to them, but they still need the instruction and the direction that we can offer them. And then if that's not working, we have someone like you to help on the other end. So, which is good.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, it's like similar to how you educate people. It really comes in phases, right? It's like the acute problem we're going to deal with. And then, you know, what does the next phase look like in the next phase? And how do you optimize that over time? So, definitely important.
And it's life-changing for a lot of these people, right? If it doesn't matter if, like you had mentioned, like a college or a professional level athlete, like they need to go to work to, you know, make a living and to provide for their family. just as much as a mother that just had her first child and can't help to, you know, take care of the child at home or other things that they need to do in the home, or if an industrial worker needs to climb a light pole to be able to change a light. I mean, they need to be able to do those things. So we see all the above. And I think it's important to understand that, you know, they aren't all the same. And if we can just understand, like we had talked about at the beginning, like the total person and understand what they need, we can then intervene and make sure that we're doing the right thing for them and it's a better outcome.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, just the education piece again is so key, because like you said, we are a society of like instant gratification. Everybody wants a pill. Everybody wants just fix me, you know, do a surgery, do whatever. And it's just like, just, you know, kind of helping people understand that that's just not the way life works. And that's not what's going to give them the better long-term outcome is very important.
Yeah. Don't go to TikTok or Instagram for your research, listeners. Make sure you look at some peer-reviewed articles or ask your surgeon.
Exactly.
What do you enjoy most about what you do every day? Like what's the thing that keeps you engaged and keeps you wanting to go back in and see patients every day? Love what you're doing. You're not going to work every day is the way I look at it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I love spine surgery. I love doing the art of spine surgery, I think is so fun because, you know, like I said, you see a patient and, you know, their imaging and their profile is, no two patients are the same. So that's extremely fun to me, you know, kind of just the excitement of a lot of the innovation that's happening in spine is really great. And I just like connecting with people, you know, so I think it's just, I love, you know, seeing my patients and seeing them do well. And I actually enjoy when patients come in and they're, you know, very fearful and they are very, you know, they don't really know what to expect, and kind of developing that relationship with them and seeing them do well, I think is really fun. Like I tell people that, you know, if you're like, oh my gosh, I spine surgery, everyone tells me never to get spine surgery. It's like so terrible and no one does well. And I, you know, I remind people that I do this for a living because people do well and I do help people.
Right.
And they get better. So I really, you know, it is a really fun, and, you know, I have a lot of sort of other things that I do as part of my job, right? So I take care of patients, but I also, you know, I have a leadership role and I love connecting with my peers and my colleagues. I do physician coaching that I really like to do, to, you know, sort of inspire people and help them tap into their own potential. I love to mentor, residents and fellows and you know, teach people and teach other surgeons how to do different techniques. So, it's just kind of all these things that sort of keep me excited every day.
That's great. And I think that's a great answer to the question. And you talked a second about mentorship. And I love to ask this question and how it influenced the guests that I have on. If you look back to mentorship as a young, you know, student coming up and rising through medical school and becoming a resident, a fellow, and now practicing as a surgeon, how did mentorship help shape you? And then do you still go back to those mentors if they're still practicing, or how do you use that to make yourself better, but also the people around you better?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think my mentors, I've been so lucky to have just amazing mentors. And again, going back to being a female in orthopedic surgery, there aren't a lot of female mentors that I had. I think that's hopefully changing over time. A lot more women are entering the field now, so I can mentor some of my, you know, female residents and fellows. But, you know, I have had amazing male mentors in the past that, that really have done a couple of things for me. So number one, they've sort of empowered me to, you know that I'm good at what I do, and to, you know, as they train me and they kind of, you know, I think a mentor really, when they believe in you, it can make or break everything. So when they say, you know what, you're good at this, you can do this, it doesn't really matter, like, you know, what you look like or what you, you know, if you're the typical orthopedic surgeon. So I think that's super important. And I think the second important thing with mentorship is sponsorship. So, you know, we mentors can kind of teach techniques and do things, but until they sort of involve you in, you know, research papers and getting you talking at meetings and, you know, connecting you with other groups and people in the field and industry groups and things like that. I think that sponsorship is so important because it helps to kind of help you thrive and grow and lifts you up in the practice. So one of my greatest mentors, Mark Palumbo, he was at Brown as when I was in fellowship, and unfortunately he passed away in 2019 from an aggressive cancer. But, you know, I literally hear him like on my shoulder sometimes in the operating room, because like, it's just, you know, I smile and I cry about it, because it's like I can hear him talking to me, and just like really influential person in my life, you know. So I think mentorship has been a huge part of my career. And I actually, you know, mentoring my mentees teach me a lot. So I am now at the phase of my career where I'm mentoring all these students and people, and they're so inspiring, you know, just seeing what people are doing and what they want to learn about and what they want to do research on and stuff like that. So I think getting that, I think a mentor really gives you that perspective. So it's not just career perspective, but it's a lot of life perspective. And I think what my mentors did for me is they gave me that early career perspective to say, life is a marathon, not a sprint. Like, you don't have to do all these things in the first 2 years of your career. Like, you want to kind of, you know, figure out who you are, what your core values are. And that may change over time. Like, once you have a family, that might change. Or once you are 15 years in a practice, that might change. And, you know, so just kind of being fluid and adaptable is one of the biggest things I learned from my mentors.
Yeah, and that was a great answer. Yeah. And I think adaptability is big. Like, that's one of the things that we all have to be able to do. And you talked about like robotic assist surgery, like that's adapting and being innovative, right? So 15, 20 years ago, would you ever thought you would have been doing robotic surgery? You know, so I think as a mentor now, and you have mentees, how does that, you know, help shape them, but also makes you think about, hey, what does my career look like moving forward? And I've always said this to students, like, mentorship's never wasted. And I still go back to people that had helped me over my career. And, you know, even the clinical students I have now, it's always, you can always reach back out. You can always give me a call if you have a, you know, a question or a concern or want advice on something that we're providing for patient care. And I think it's a great way for us to continue to be good at what we do, but also become better.
Yeah. I mean, my training was completely different than what I do in practice now. I mean, there's just the evolution and the teaching of different techniques and things like that has been really fun. But the fundamentals are all the same, right?
Yeah.
So,
Which is great. So surgery aside, professional, Dr. Adelin aside, what do you like to do in your free time when you're not researching, when you're not helping people get better? What's your thing that you love to do?
Yeah, well, I think one of the reasons why I connect so much with my active patients is because I just love to be very physically active. So, you know, I just ran the marathon the other day. You know, I love doing, you know, long cycling endurance things and sprint triathlons and things like that. I just like to really be active and exercise. And you know, I think it's not only good for my own health, but it's good being a role model for my patients and for my kids and my family. So that's a really big part of my life. Definitely love just, you know, spending time with my family and my kids as much as I can. We love to travel, you know, just kind of be doing adventurous things and getting out there. Anything that I can really do to kind of connect with people outside is really fun. I just like being outdoors and, you know, just want to kind of live life fullest for the most part when I'm not working.
Yeah, I know, right? Or we're always working, but I think life's too short. We have to enjoy, stop and smell the roses a little bit, right? And I think
for
mental health too. I mean, I'll work out. I get up early in the morning and work out just because that's the time I can do it, and it just gives me time to think about the day and what's coming up for that day, the next day, and you know what we're going to do to get better, which is great. So, great talking to you today. I really appreciate you coming on. I know we just talked about it briefly. You ran the New York City Marathon this past weekend. So I'm sure there's still some recovery that's going on. But congratulations on that. And I wish you all the success with your practice. You do a great job. And thanks for taking care of our patients when we send them over to you.
Oh, thank you so much. Yes, I'm still back being in the marathon. I'm definitely sore. It's nice to be sitting for a few minutes. but no, I, you know, likewise, I super appreciate our partnership and our ability to take care of patients together. And yeah, this was really fun.
Great. I appreciate it. We'll have to do another one in the future.
Definitely.
Thanks, Dr. Adelin.
All right. Thanks. Have a great day.
Thank you for tuning in to the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. At AJR, we're committed to offering a comprehensive range of exceptional services, including applied sports science analytics, healthcare and sports medicine consulting, and leadership and coaching development. To learn more about AJR, visit their website at ajrsportsscience.com. This is your host, Andrew Rizza. If you enjoyed today's episode, give us a like, comment, and share it on social media. Access all of our episodes on platforms such as Apple, Spotify, or your preferred podcast app. Stay updated by following us on Instagram at Behind Sports Med Podcast, on X at AJR Sports Sci, or visiting our website at ajrsportsscience.podbean.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at AJR Sports Science for upcoming content. Thank you for tuning in and stay tuned for our next episode.